Državni izpitni center. Splošna matura 2019. Lepo pozdravljeni. Pričenja se reševanje izpitne pole slušnega razumevanja angleščine. Izpitna pola je sestavljena iz dveh delov, dela A in dela B. Vsak del vsebuje govorjeno izhodiščno besedilo in nalogo, ki se nanj nanaša. Najprej boste nalogo prebrali in jo nato med poslušanjem besedila sproti reševali. Vsako besedilo boste poslušali po dvakrat. Začetek in konec besedila bo označeval takle zvočni znak. Rešitve pišite z nalivnim peresom ali s kemičnim svinčnikom v izpitno polo v zato predvideni prostor znotraj okvirja. Pišite čitljivo in skladno s pravopisnimi pravili. Če se zmotite, napisano prečrtajte in rešitev zapišite na novo. Nečitljivi zapisi in nejasni popravki bodo ocenjeni z nič točkami. Zaupajte vase in v svoje zmožnosti. Želimo vam veliko uspeha. Poslušajte pozorno. Odprite izpitno polo.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Jennifer Egan, the Pulitzer Prize winner. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
But first, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Visit from the Goon Squad, Jennifer Egan, who I last spoke to 7 years ago, shortly before she picked up that prize. Past novels have delved into the cruelties of the beauty business, predicted the explosion of smartphones and social media, run rampage through the music business, and employed fragmentary narrative techniques. Now, proving her versatility, a historical opus set in New York during World War II. Manhattan Beach is dense with detail and sublimely evocative in bringing to life the great ships, crowded bars, and lives lived around the Brooklyn Naval Yard, where Allied warships were repaired and constructed. It follows the fortunes of a feisty, pioneering young heroine, Anna Kerrigan, who becomes the Docklands' only female diver, and the two men who shape her life. Eddie, the father who abandons her, and Dexter Stiles, the suave gangster who once employed him. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, it's a wonderful angle on New York, eschewing this kind of familiarity of Manhattan from Wall Street to Broadway to look outward at the ocean. You evoke a shipbuilding metropolis and the titular shoreside communities of the 1940s. So what drew you to that period? And can you set the scene a bit for our listeners? You'll do it so much better than me.
Well, I think what drew me originally was just curiosity about New York during World War II. Looking back, I think it probably had to do with 9/11. The city felt like a war zone overnight. And there was basically from that point forward a great fear of further attacks. And I knew that during World War II, there had been a lot of worry about a sea invasion or an air attack.
So that sense of unease.
Yeah, the sense of unease and of vulnerability. And so I started looking at images of New York during the war. And the first thing that struck me was that it was all about the water. And that was really unexpected because you can live in New York for years, as I had then, and barely experience the water. I mean, now the waterfront is actually sort of coming back and there are beautiful parks and things, but that wasn't so much the case when I moved there in the 80s. So I really followed the water, I would say, into the various worlds that kind of come together in this book. One of them is the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was an incredibly important place for the Allies. It repaired 5,000 ships. Many, many women worked there, as they did in all kinds of industry during the war, almost 5,000 of them at the height of the war.
But not many women were divers, were there any?
I don't think there. Well, first of all, I had not known until I was researching the Brooklyn Navy Yard that diving was a part of ship repair. Although, of course, it makes sense when you think about it. I learned that there were civilian divers, and I had a feeling I was going to send a woman down instead of a man. I don't believe there were any female divers at the Navy Yard. I don't know that there weren't. It's somewhat unlikely that a woman would have dived, and yet the nature of the war, and this in a way is what made it such an interesting period to write about, is that things were very upside down. You know, for the sake of expedience, women were doing all kinds of things they'd never done before.
Now you will hear the recording again.
But first, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of A Visit from the Goon Squad, Jennifer Egan, who I last spoke to 7 years ago, shortly before she picked up that prize. Past novels have delved into the cruelties of the beauty business, predicted the explosion of smartphones and social media, run rampage through the music business, and employed fragmentary narrative techniques. Now, proving her versatility, a historical opus set in New York during World War II. Manhattan Beach is dense with detail and sublimely evocative in bringing to life the great ships, crowded bars, and lives lived around the Brooklyn Naval Yard, where Allied warships were repaired and constructed. It follows the fortunes of a feisty, pioneering young heroine, Anna Kerrigan, who becomes the Docklands' only female diver, and the two men who shape her life. Eddie, the father who abandons her, and Dexter Stiles, the suave gangster who once employed him. Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, it's a wonderful angle on New York, eschewing this kind of familiarity of Manhattan from Wall Street to Broadway to look outward at the ocean. You evoke a shipbuilding metropolis and the titular shoreside communities of the 1940s. So what drew you to that period? And can you set the scene a bit for our listeners? You'll do it so much better than me.
Well, I think what drew me originally was just curiosity about New York during World War II. Looking back, I think it probably had to do with 9/11. The city felt like a war zone overnight. And there was basically from that point forward a great fear of further attacks. And I knew that during World War II, there had been a lot of worry about a sea invasion or an air attack.
So that sense of unease.
Yeah, the sense of unease and of vulnerability. And so I started looking at images of New York during the war. And the first thing that struck me was that it was all about the water. And that was really unexpected because you can live in New York for years, as I had then, and barely experience the water. I mean, now the waterfront is actually sort of coming back and there are beautiful parks and things, but that wasn't so much the case when I moved there in the 80s. So I really followed the water, I would say, into the various worlds that kind of come together in this book. One of them is the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was an incredibly important place for the Allies. It repaired 5,000 ships. Many, many women worked there, as they did in all kinds of industry during the war, almost 5,000 of them at the height of the war.
But not many women were divers, were there? Were there any?
I don't think there. Well, first of all, I had not known until I was researching the Brooklyn Navy Yard that diving was a part of ship repair. Although, of course, it makes sense when you think about it. I learned that there were civilian divers, and I had a feeling I was going to send a woman down instead of a man. I don't believe there were any female divers at the Navy Yard. I don't know that there weren't. It's somewhat unlikely that a woman would have dived, and yet the nature of the war, and this in a way is what made it such an interesting period to write about, is that things were very upside down. You know, for the sake of expedience, women were doing all kinds of things they'd never done before.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear an interview in which Patricia Farah talks about Lisa Meitner, who together with her colleagues Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann discovered nuclear fission. You will hear the recording twice. Now read the task.
To find out more about Lisa Meitner and what it was like for a woman working as a scientist in early 20th century Germany, I spoke to historian of science at the University of Cambridge, Patricia Farah.
From very early on, she felt herself to be an outsider. She was so good at mathematical subjects at school, but of course, when she was being brought up in Vienna, women couldn't go to university. And then later on, she went to Germany, and again, she was on the outside, but she was the first woman to become a professor in Germany. And then there's, of course, also the fact that she was Jewish, and although she'd converted and become a Protestant, she was very, very much an outsider in 1930s Germany because of that.
And right from the outset, she began to work with Otto Hahn, the key relationship in her life. What was that relationship like?
Well, I think with both Otto Hahn and the younger physicist that Hahn later employed, a man called Strassmann, they were both very anti-Nazi and pro-Jewish. So at the outset, I think their relationship was very close. It was a very collaborative relationship. He was a chemist and she was a physicist. And the crucial set of experiments, the one that would prove so formative in both their lives, was when they bombarded uranium with neutrons, and they wanted to see what would happen to the atom of the uranium. And most of the experiments up till then had shown that if you bombard a uranium atom with neutrons, a little bit sort of chips away. And their results completely overturned that assumption. And one of the things that Lisa Meitner did was she kept asking Otto Hahn to repeat his experiments because she couldn't believe the results. She was very sceptical about it at first, and then he did repeat his experiments. And then eventually she and her nephew managed to work out what had been happening.
This was the experiment that Hahn and Strassmann did after Meitner had left Germany, where they had these results and they didn't know how to interpret them, and they sent them to Meitner. What happened then?
There's this lovely story. It was one Christmas, and she and her nephew went for a walk, and he was on skis and she was walking, and they were discussing this, and they sat down on a tree trunk and they got a piece of paper out and started scribbling all the equations. And it was her who worked out the maths of exactly what it was that had happened, and she imagined the nucleus of uranium being like a giant drop, and that somehow the uranium drop had got squeezed into the middle and then split into two parts. It was like a biological cell splitting into two, and that's why it's called fission. It's called that after the biology. And it was her who did all the physics of all of that, but that part that she played was written out of the story.
And no one had appreciated before that something like this could happen to an atomic nucleus.
No, it just didn't seem to have crossed their minds, and that's why the results were so bewildering. They were all feeling in the dark, and nothing like this had ever happened before.
Do you think they had any sense when they were doing this work of where ultimately it might lead?
They had absolutely no idea that they were leading to nuclear fission. It certainly wasn't an aim. It certainly wasn't an aim as far as Lisa Meitner was concerned, because as soon as she realised that enormous amounts of energy could be released through this reaction, she said, I don't want to have anything to do with an atomic bomb. And she was asked to work on the atomic bomb project, and she refused to do that. But while these experiments were happening, other scientists became aware of the potential, and various people contacted Albert Einstein and asked him to write to President Roosevelt in America and urge President Roosevelt to start an atomic bomb program in America, because these scientists were very worried that the Germans might be developing a bomb, and from their perspective.
Now you will hear the recording again.
To find out more about Lisa Meitner and what it was like for a woman working as a scientist in early 20th century Germany, I spoke to historian of science at the University of Cambridge, Patricia Farah.
From very early on, she felt herself to be an outsider. She was so good at mathematical subjects at school, but of course, when she was being brought up in Vienna, women couldn't go to university. And then later on, she went to Germany, and again, she was on the outside, but she was the first woman to become a professor in Germany. And then there's, of course, also the fact that she was Jewish, and although she'd converted and become a Protestant, she was very, very much an outsider in 1930s Germany because of that.
And right from the outset, she began to work with Otto Hahn, the key relationship in her life. What was that relationship like?
Well, I think with both Otto Hahn and the younger physicist that Hahn later employed, a man called Strassmann, they were both very anti-Nazi and pro-Jewish. So at the outset, I think their relationship was very close. It was a very collaborative relationship. He was a chemist and she was a physicist. And the crucial set of experiments, the one that would prove so formative in both their lives, was when they bombarded uranium with neutrons and they wanted to see what would happen to the atom of the uranium. And most of the experiments up till then had shown that if you bombard a uranium atom with neutrons a little bit sort of chips away. And their results completely overturned that assumption. And one of the things that Lisa Meitner did was she kept asking Otto Hahn to repeat his experiments because she couldn't believe the results. She was very sceptical about it at first, and then he did repeat his experiments. And then eventually she and her nephew managed to work out what had been happening.
This was the experiment that Hahn and Strassmann did after Meitner had left Germany, where they had these results and they didn't know how to interpret them and they sent them to Meitner. What happened then?
There's this lovely story. It was one Christmas and she and her nephew went for a walk and he was on skis and she was walking and they were discussing this and they sat down on a tree trunk and they got a piece of paper out and started scribbling all the equations. And it was her who worked out the maths of exactly what it was that had happened. And she imagined the nucleus of uranium being like a giant drop, and that somehow the uranium drop had got squeezed into the middle and then split into two parts. It was like a biological cell splitting into two, and that's why it's called fission. It's called that after the biology. And it was her who did all the physics of all of that, but that part that she played was written out of the story.
And no one had appreciated before that something like this could happen to an atomic nucleus.
No, it just didn't seem to have crossed their minds, and that's why the results were so bewildering. They were all feeling in the dark, and nothing like this had ever happened before.
Do you think they had any sense when they were doing this work of where ultimately it might lead?
They had absolutely no idea that they were leading to nuclear fission. It certainly wasn't an aim. It certainly wasn't an aim as far as Lisa Meitner was concerned, because as soon as she realised that enormous amounts of energy could be released through this reaction, she said, I don't want to have anything to do with an atomic bomb. And she was asked to work on the atomic bomb project and she refused to do that. But while these experiments were happening, other scientists became aware of the potential and various people contacted Albert Einstein and asked him to write to President Roosevelt in America and urge President Roosevelt to start an atomic bomb program in America, because these scientists were very worried that the Germans might be developing a bomb. And from their perspective, what it was.
This is the end of Section B.
Končuje se slušno preverjanje angleščine. Nehajte pisati, zaprite izpitno polo in jo položite na rob mize. Nasvidenje in srečno!